What a pain.
Dead from 11 to 1.
Maybe if I do that, it might stay. We'll see. So, I'll take a couple of questions here. Don't have a lot of time for questions because I do have another 57 chapters, but yeah.
So you said that in Genesis 3:16 it says he and our first is afraid of Jesus.
All right, the traditional Christian interpretation of Genesis 3:14 and 15 is the woman, in quotes, represents the believers.
Okay.
And then the one, the one who will strike the heel is Satan.
Okay.
And in Revelation, the woman in that one vision is the church later on. So, you know, I don't think she is the church per se, but that's one way in which that prophecy is fulfilled. It's certainly not the most specific messianic prophecy going, but I think in Genesis you see some relatively faint hints about the Messiah, at least in prophetic form. We're going to see some of the actual events in Genesis are clear pictures of Messiah, but as far as historically, you know, compared to, for example, Isaiah 53 or Psalm 22, the written prophecies are relatively faint by comparison. Okay? Yeah.
Is there a scripture that talks about God subjecting the world to frustration or something?
That's in Romans.
What does that mean? I mean, it's almost like...
Well, I think he's speaking somewhat figuratively there. I mean, it's like, that's Paul. He's saying, you know, the creation was meant to be good and not evil, and it's been subjected. He's sort of personifying creation itself, not that creation is a person. He's personifying there. And so it's saying creation is being subjected to all these things, these unnatural things, that I think when he's saying creation, he's in a sense saying himself in a way, but I'm not being a pantheist, okay? I'm not saying creation is God, but so I think he's personifying creation there. Just like in Proverbs says, wisdom says, well, wisdom is not a person, and wisdom doesn't really say anything. So I think it's a personification. Okay, yeah.
Before sin came into the world, God gave man work. Tend the garden and stuff like that.
So yeah.
Have you read anything in the literature about what theological implications it has for man and work?
Well, man having a particular role in work separate from women's role seems to come from Genesis chapter 3. Right, where God says you guys are going to be doing the hard physical labor of producing crops, essentially, and women will be involved, among other things, obviously, in the hard physical labor of giving birth. I don't get that hard separate role necessarily from Genesis chapter 2.
I'm thinking more in terms of like the old Protestant philosophy of, you know, work is good, and that if you do good at your job, you're pleasing God. And
yeah, I find that in lots of places. I find it in Ecclesiastes. I find that in lots of places. But Solomon definitely praises the idea of work and its role in giving you fulfillment. And God, I believe, gave Adam and Eve some stuff to do, because if they're just sitting around with a machine dropping food in their mouth, they probably would not have had as great a life. Yeah, I mean, God works, and part of God's pleasure is to work, and I think work is part of one of the gifts that God gave us. Unfortunately, in a fallen world, some of that work can be degrading and demeaning, but God didn't intend that, for sure. But even in our fallen situation, work is good. And certainly Solomon acknowledges that as one of the pleasures. Right? That's easy to say for Solomon, harder to say for some other people, but I still think it's true. Okay, one more question, yeah.
Is it correct to say that Jesus was always God's plan to be saved?
Yes. In 1 Corinthians 6, it says the Lamb of God slain from the creation of the world.
So what I don't always understand is if that is true, then did God know we're not going to love Him back?
Alright, yeah. Now, yeah, it's hard for us as human beings to conceive of the fact that God can foreknow without predetermining. That's why some deep stuff that was not the intention of this class today. But obviously God knows. I mean, Jesus didn't say, I was. He says, I am. You know, before Abraham was born, I am. So from our human perspective, well, how's that work? I mean, so there's no surprises, you know? Isn't that one of the great things to have a surprise? I don't think there are a lot of surprises for God. I mean, the Bible speaks of God being surprised, but, you know, how's that work exactly? I'd say, let's just get to heaven. We'll kind of figure out how all that works. But, yeah, I mean, you know, it might seem to be a contradiction. God created Adam and Eve in this place and gave them a choice, but how could it be a choice if He knew what they were going to choose? But that's the nature of God. That's, from a human perspective, that's really hard to swallow. But I think from God's perspective, that's just normal, I guess. I don't know. All right, good. Maybe we'll have some time for some questions at the end, but I have a feeling we won't because I've got too much material. But anyway, we'll see. So now we're in Genesis chapter 4. Wow. Cain killed Abel. And to me, Genesis chapter 4 is, once sin gets in, it just goes downhill from there. And it just goes from bad to worse. You know, things didn't get better with their children. And when we make bad decisions, it clearly, and set bad examples like Adam and Eve did, it clearly has a negative effect on our children. When sin gets in, it doesn't get better. At chapter 4, verse 6, it says, sin is crouching at your door. Does it feel that way? Sin is crouching at your door. And God says, so, I understand if you sin because, you know, it's crouching at your door. No. He didn't say that. It says, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it. Well, how did Cain do? He didn't do very well. It didn't. In fact, he killed his own brother. Remember last week we read, from the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah? And from God's perspective, the story of human beings without God is just a litany of destruction and devastation. And a lot of us have experienced that destruction and devastation because that's the world without God. And so, once, yeah.
John, by the way, that's John, Genesis 4:7.
Oh, okay, Genesis 4:7. Thank you. Fix it in my notes. Genesis 4:7. All right. James 1:13-15 kind of breaks it down, doesn't it? Let's read that. James 1:13-15 kind of breaks down the whole sin thing. It says, now no one undergoing a trial should say, I am being tempted by God. For God is not tempted by evil, and He Himself does not tempt anyone. So, Satan wasn't there because God was trying to tempt them, although Satan was trying to tempt them. And the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was not there to tempt them. It was there because God loved them. All right. But each person is tempted when he's drawn away and enticed by his own evil desires. And basically, that's what Genesis 4:6 says. It's crouching at your door. Then after desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is fully grown, it gives birth to death. So the story of Genesis chapter 4 is the story of sin and separation and judgment and death. It's kind of a sad story. But guess what? It got even worse. It just went from there, from bad to worse. And by the time you get to Genesis chapter 6, God is bawling. He is just disconsolate. He's devastated. because of how the world turned out, because people had become so evil. So God decided to judge the world. But before that, there's Genesis 5. I'm not going to read through Genesis 5, but Genesis 5 is the first genealogy. So it's Adam, Seth, blah, 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 Noah. Again, we got Adam through Noah, through Abraham, through David, etc. Finally down to Jesus. So it's kind of a picture. Here's the lineage. The first man, the first Adam. The lineage turning, looking forward towards the second Adam. So now we're in Genesis chapter 6. And here we see, we've seen some prefigures and foreshadows. We've seen Adam as a picture of Jesus in reverse, in a sense, as it says in Romans 5. And we've seen Adam and Eve as a picture of us in our relationship with God, in our separation from God because of our sin. And then we see the flood. And the flood is the first major picture of judgment. Genesis chapter 4 is about punishment. Genesis chapter 3 is about punishment. But Genesis chapter 6 is about judgment. Let's read in Genesis chapter 6, verse 6. It's a pretty tough story here. I'm going to start in verse 5. And you can read verse 1 through 4 about the corruption and how terrible it became. People without God are gross and disgusting and evil and depraved. None of this, we're getting better and better, humanism stuff, that's nonsense. Anyway, verse 5. When the Lord saw that man's wickedness was widespread on the earth, and every scheme his mind thought of was nothing but evil all the time. And that was us. Romans chapter 3. You know that part about none is all the same. We all alike have gone astray. You know, and it's a rather dark picture. The Lord regretted he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. This is kind of the low point of the story. It doesn't, in fact, even in the whole Bible, it doesn't get any worse than it got in Genesis chapter 6. It actually gets slightly better after Genesis 6. How? Because God judges and he removes all those unrighteous people. How many righteous people were there on the entire earth? Eight. Yeah, we don't, the other seven we don't know a whole lot about. I mean, relatively. And remember, this is the time of the patriarchs. There was only one patriarch left. And it's like the last light was about to go out. And God said, I'm just going to... But then he decided, no, I'm going to leave behind Noah and his family. So the story of Genesis 6 is the story of judgment. But remember this, every time God foreshadows judgment, he also foreshadows salvation. And the same flood that destroyed the earth saved Noah and his family. Let's read about that in 2 Peter chapter 3. Because God fully intended what he did to the earth in the days of Noah as a picture of what he's going to do at the end of time. Noah preached for 100 years. Noah, a righteous man, built the ark. You can read about that in Hebrews 11. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 5 through 9. I'll go back to verse 3. First, be aware of this. Scoffers will come in their last days to scoff, following their own lust and saying, where is this promise of his coming? Where is it? For ever since our fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they've been since the beginning of creation. They willfully ignore this. Long ago, the heavens and the earth were existed out of water, and through water, by the word of God, through these, the world of that time was perished. when it was flooded by water. By the same word, the present heavens and earth are held in store for fire, being kept until the day of judgment and destruction of godly men. And he says, you know, God is not slow about his promises. To him, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years like a day. So he's saying, what happened in the days of Noah is going to happen again. But what did he say in Genesis chapter 8? He said, remember the covenant with Noah? He said, never again will I do it by water. Instead, I'm going to do it by fire. He did it by fire. And so that's what 1 Peter is saying. So, the story of Genesis chapter 6 is the story of judgment. That God will judge the rebellious, those who refuse to obey Him. God's heart was filled with pain. You know, the flood is a picture of what happened. It actually happened. It is a historical event. I believe it happened. I believe God miraculously created the water, covered the earth, and then miraculously removed the water. It's a picture of what happened, but I think it's a picture of the world today. The world in the day of Noah is pretty much the same as the world today. Because people are eating and drinking and acting as if nothing's happening. They're saying, oh yeah, you know, Jesus said that 2,000 years ago. Who believes it? They say, you know, the apostles, even they thought it would happen within one generation. It's been 2,000 years. Whatever. You know, this guy, 2,000 years ago, what are you talking about? Final judgment. It's going to be by fire. But you know what? When Jesus appears in the sky, those people are going to have kind of a bad deal there. And when, you know, when it started raining, you know, when if you read the flood story, when it started raining, Noah closed the door and nailed it shut. Because once it starts raining, it's too late. And that's what's going to happen. That's what God is saying in this story. There's going to come a time when people are saying, eat, drink, and marry, for tomorrow we die, and then judgment is going to come, and it's going to be too late when Jesus comes in the sky. And a lot of people are not happy. I'm sure when it started raining, because Noah preached for 100 years. They say, yeah, whatever, Noah. Kind of like they said to you when you shared your faith with your neighbor, yeah, whatever. Sure. But you know, when it started raining and it poured rain, do you think after about 5 days in a row pouring rain as the waters come, they're thinking, man, should have listened. That's what's going to happen. But you know, the same flood that judged the earth, that same water saved Noah and his family, right? 1 Peter chapter 3. Let's turn there. Not 2 Peter. We already read 2 Peter 3. See, 2 Peter chapter 3 is about the fact that the flood is a foreshadow of judgment. But 1 Peter chapter 3 is about the fact that the flood is also a foreshadow of baptism, right? Absolutely. 1 Peter chapter 3. We Church of Christers, we're up on that one. We got that one covered. No problem. All right. Those who disobeyed long ago when God waited patiently in the days of Noah while the ark was being built, in it a few people, eight in all, were saved through water. And this water symbolizes baptism that now saves you also. Not the removal of dirt from the flesh, but the pledge of a good conscience towards God. It saves you by the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who's gone into heaven and is at God's right hand with angels and authorities and powers in submission to Him. So the story of the flood of Noah is about God's judgment. God will judge those who rebel against Him. Is that a happy story? Popular story? No, but it's one that we need to hear. And Noah's righteous behavior speaks even today. He didn't get a whole lot of converts, you know? Not a whole lot of converts. 100 years. You've been preaching for 5 years and nobody's been baptized. Well, how about 100 years and then nobody got baptized? And then his family got baptized. But Noah's still helping people to become Christians today. I don't want to go into the whole different, you know, the local flood, worldwide flood stuff, and all the cultural accounts and the Gilgamesh epic and all that sort of stuff. I'm going to skip that. One thing for sure is the New Testament writers believe the flood was real. Matthew 24, 38 through 39. And Jesus thought it was real. And so I believe it happened. Alright, I believe it happened. I mean, if Jesus said it happened, it seems that's good enough for me. I can go with that. 2 Peter 3 says why it happened. It happened because of judgment. but also as a foreshadow of salvation. It's a prefigure of judgment. It's a prefigure of salvation as well. And I believe it's true because the Bible says it's true. That's good enough for me. I don't need to be sophisticated about this kind of stuff. Not sophisticated. Bible says it. I believe it.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11, the second genealogy. Because Hebrews, I keep saying Hebrews. For the next 30 minutes, if I say Hebrews, just turn into Genesis. I don't know. All right, so anyway, Genesis 5, you know, Adam, Seth, blah, 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 Noah. Then Genesis 11, Adam, Seth, blah, blah, Noah, blah, 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 Terah, Abraham. And so basically saying we're taking snapshots at particularly important moments. Because there's a long story, but that story has definite highlights. And we're looking at kind of like the highlight reel. When they show you the highlight reels on ESPN tonight, right, Fern? When they show you the highlight reels, they don't show you them just dribbling around. They show the slam dunks, right? So we're, you know, the slug was like a slam dunk, you know? And this one's going to be like, I don't know, a steal or something like that. I don't know. The analogy is terrible. Kate, sorry for using a sport. Kate gets mad all the time about people use sports analogies. We should use clothes analogies and stuff like that. Yeah. All right. So there you go. We're going to summarize the rest of the book of Genesis here. Okay? Genesis 12 through 23, God chooses a man of faith as the father of faith and through whom to send the Messiah. And then Genesis 24 through 50, God prepares, now that he's picked his man, now he's preparing a people. God chooses a man, he has a plan, and he's choosing a people. Genesis 24 through 50. We're going to see that happen. Pretty simple. Okay, the man, Abraham. And Abraham, I would argue, if you could pick any single person in the Old Testament, it's the chief human person to look at that God puts up there as a representation of what he has in mind, it would be Abraham. Moses could certainly be nominated for that as well. Abraham. And Abraham is a type. And the anti-type is us. So the story of Abraham is the story of us. The story of Adam and Eve is the story of us, but it's the story of us before we were saved. It's the bad story of us, right? And the story of Abraham is the story of us. It's the story that if you leave everything behind by faith, and if you walk by faith, you will walk in the promised land. And you'll be saved. Salvation is not by works. It is by faith. So Abraham is a type, and we are the anti-type. Romans chapter 4, where God says this. Paul says it. God says it through Paul. He's explaining what Abraham is all about. All right, verse 11, Romans 4, it says, "And he received the sign of circumcision, a seal." And he's talking about the covenant with Abraham. That's going to be Genesis 17. Genesis 17, again, we talked about last week, Genesis 12 is kind of like a covenant. Genesis 15 is kind of like a covenant. But Genesis 17 is where that covenant is sealed. The seal of that covenant is circumcision. And that's when Abraham and all of his male relatives were circumcised and the covenant was sealed at that point. Anyway, it says, "He received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness that he had by faith, while he was still uncircumcised." So he's saying, even though he got circumcised, and that was a seal of that covenant, he was already saved. Why? Because he'd already left Ur. He'd already left Haran. He was already, in quotes, disciple, if you will. All right, he'd already left everything behind and was walking by faith. That's what he's saying. All right, and so then he's the father of all. And you see, father of, he's the representative of all. He is the type, the ultimate symbol, if you will, the one who came before all the others. Alright? So he is the father of all who believe but have not been circumcised, in order that righteousness might be credited to them. He is the father of the circumcised who are not only circumcised, but also walk in the footsteps of the faith that our father Abraham. He's saying he's the father of the Jews who walk by faith and to the Gentiles who walk by faith. He's just the father of them all. Verse 16. Therefore, the promise comes by faith, so it may be by grace, may be guaranteed to all Abraham's offspring. And who are Abraham's offspring? Us, those who walk by faith. Not only to those who are of the law, but also to those of the faith of Abraham. He is the father of us all. As it is written, and he's quoting from Genesis, of course, I've made you the father of many nations. Alright, so that's the cool stuff about Abraham. The story of Abraham is the story of salvation by faith. Now, God made a bunch of promises. Why did God make so many awesome promises with Abraham? Why? I gave you a hint, and it was about 15 seconds ago. Why did God make all these awesome promises to Abraham? Because of his faith. Alright? So, you know, in nursery school and in Sunday school, if you fall asleep and they ask you a question, just say, Jesus died for my sins, alright? You can do that. Alright, so if we're talking about Abraham, just say faith. Faith, just faith. It'd probably be right. At least a 40% chance it'll be right. You say, why did Abraham lie to Pharaoh? Faith. Whatever. So Abraham is a type. So Genesis 12:2, God says, I'm going to make you into a great nation. Abraham's like, really? Me? 75 years old, my wife, I don't know how old she was, but she was getting up there. All right. I'm going to be a great nation? Genesis 12:3, all nations will be blessed through you. All nations. A clear picture that through Abraham will come the Messiah. Genesis 13:15, I will give you this land. And God gave Abraham that land, but he gave it to his seed. And Paul says the seed is Jesus. Because the land is heaven. Hey, the land is the promised land. But the promised land is just a picture, right? Because when they left Egypt, they left their life of sin. They wandered in the wilderness. There's the life of a disciple, only to enter the promised land. So the seed is Jesus. And the land is heaven. But of course, the seed is also his 12 children and the 12 tribes who would occupy Canaan. So this is a prophecy fulfilled in more than one way. Genesis 15:4-5, I will give you a son and your offspring will be like the stars in the sky and the sand in the sea. You're going to have millions and millions of offspring. It's true. How many million people are directly descended from Abraham? I don't know, but all the Arabs and all the Jews, that's a lot. And a few other people as well. The Edomites, right? Ishmael. The Edomites are from Esau. And the Arabs are from Ishmael. And lots. So God fulfilled that one. And then Genesis 17:6, he says, kings will come from you. What kings? David, Solomon, Rehoboam. And then the greatest king of all, obviously. So God made many promises to Abraham. Why? Because of his faith. And because it was part of his plan. Because, I mean, Genesis 5, Genesis 6 is so depressing. It'd be easy to look around the world and get really depressed. Because it's disgusting out there. It's terrible. But God's working. He's working. He was waiting. He's waiting, and because, nobody like Abraham came around. But Abraham was a man of an unbelievable, unimaginable faith. And so God chose him. And he said to Abraham, your descendant will bless all the nations. See, God has a plan. And that's what's going on in Genesis. Genesis, it's the genesis, if you will, of the plan to send the Messiah. Alright, a few more things about Abraham. There's so much symbolism in Abraham. It's crazy. Now, Abraham had two children, right? Two sons, Ishmael and Isaac. If you were to ask the Jews, which are you, Ishmael or Isaac? They'd say, we're Isaac. Wrong. They're Ishmael. Right? Because Ishmael is a slave. And Ishmael was born, like he says in Galatians 4, the usual way. I mean, how much faith does it take to make a Jew? None.
It takes two Jews.
It takes Mama Jew, Papa Jew, Baby Jew. No faith at all. Why was Ishmael born? Because of Abraham's faith? No, because of his lack of faith.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And then, you know, Jesus said to the Jews, you're all a bunch of slaves. And you're children of slaves. They weren't happy to hear that. By the way, they had the opportunity to be children of Abraham. They thought they were. But how do you become children of Abraham?
Faith.
Huh? See, that's the message of the Old Testament. All right, and so in Galatians 4, God said, God said through Paul that Ishmael was born the usual way. He says, no, Isaac was the child of promise. Isaac was born as the result not of sex because of his lack of faith, but because of a promise. Isaac is the son of promise, and we too are the children of promise. Let's go to Galatians 4. Some pretty good stuff there. So why is it that God allowed Abraham to sin in this way? Well, I mean, it was part of his... I don't know if Abraham wanted to do that. God wanted to do that. But all I know is it resulted in this awesome picture. This foreshadow. Galatians. How am I doing? Oh, we're making progress anyway. Okay. Come on, Galatians. Chapter 4 says, tell me who want to be under the law. Are you not aware of what the law says? Verse 21. For it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by the slave woman and one by the free woman. His son by the slave woman was born in the usual way. But his son by the free woman was born as a result of a promise. These things may be taken figuratively. For the women represent two covenants. One from Mount Sinai, who bears children who are to be slaves. This is Hagar. Now, Hagar stands for Mount Sinai in Arabia and corresponds to the present city of Jerusalem. He's saying Hagar represents Judaism, represents the temple and the Jews, and they're slaves. They're not free. He says, because she's in slavery with her children, but the Jerusalem that above is free, she's our mother, for it is written, etc. Verse 28, now you brothers like Isaac are children of promise. At that time, the son born in the ordinary way persecuted the son born by the power of the Spirit. And that's a cool foreshadow as well, because when the church was born, when the children of Isaac were born, what did the children of Ishmael, the Jews, what did the Jews do to the church? They persecuted it. Just like Ishmael persecuted Isaac when he was born. And then what did Sarah do? She kicked him out. And God did that as well. God waited till the year 70 AD. The Roman army came, surrounded the city of Jerusalem as Jesus had prophesied. And the Jews were kicked out of Jerusalem. The temple was leveled and Judaism came to an end from God's perspective. All that was foreshadowed right here in the life of Abraham, Isaac, Hagar, and Ishmael. Kind of cool. And then there's Genesis 22, 2 through 14. Now that's a great one. I love that one. I think I might have read this one in a sermon recently. I did, yes? Alright. So we don't have to go through the whole thing. So God says to Abraham, take your son, your only son, Isaac, and sacrifice him on Mount Moriah, and the place where I'll tell you. And in this story, of course, Abraham represents God, and Isaac represents God's son, his one and only son, his special son, the son that he loved. Abraham was not really excited about killing his own son, but the father was not really happy to see his son hanging on the cross. God was not like, son, too bad for you, man. You're going to have, you know, that's your problem. I mean, Abraham was not happy. God was not happy. And of course it says in 1 Corinthians 15 that the sun would rise from the dead on the third day. And on the third day, Abraham arrived at Mount Moriah and he received his son back from the dead. Hebrews 11:19, it says, figuratively, Abraham received his son back from the dead on the third day. And the place where Abraham went was Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah is the same place where God sacrificed his one and only son. Coincidence? No, I don't think so. I think God had in mind to send the Messiah. No, this was not some accident. God wasn't, you know, it wasn't some last minute thought. I don't, man, we got a problem here. What am I going to do? Oh, I know. I'll be born in Bethlehem. And, you know, I mean, God had a plan all along, and he showed that right here in Genesis. You see the plan clearly laid out. Here's what God's going to do. Salvation is by faith. So I'm going to take a man of faith and his son who's born because of that faith, and I'm going to use them as a picture of the Messiah. So they come to Mount Moriah, and as you can see in the picture, God has Isaac carry the wood up the mountain that was going to be used for his very own sacrifice. Just like Jesus carried up the wood up the same mountain. The same mountain. Carried wood up the same mountain that was going to be used for his own sacrifice. And Isaac willingly said to his father, you know, essentially, yeah, either that or Abraham kind of knocked him out, punched him, and sort of tied him up. You can imagine Isaac fighting. I don't think so. I don't think that's how it happened. Abraham would not have done that. All right? The faith of Abraham. Just imagine the faith of Abraham willing to give his one and only son. In Hebrews 11 it says, he reasoned. He thought it out. This is. I mean, could you have thought it out in view of all the emotions? He reasoned that God could raise him from the dead. And like the Hebrew writer says, figuratively, he did. Because I'm telling you, Abraham, he would have killed him. He would have done it. Right? But God provided a ram. Right? And you know the rest of the story. It's a pretty good story. And then there's Melchizedek. Genesis 14. I don't have time to get into Melchizedek. All right. Without genealogy, without descendants, without beginning of days or end of life, a priest forever, the king of Salem. Salem, Shalom. King of Shalom, King of Peace, the King of Righteousness, which is what his name means, a priest, but not a blob of Melchizedek. That's great. Now, I want to do a very, very brief side trip to talk about archaeology for a little bit. Because a lot of people say, ah, these are just a bunch of stories, you know. They're nice stories. Well, they're pretty amazing given that, look at Genesis 22 and tell me that that's not a picture of what actually happened. Tell me it's not. If that's just a fable somebody made up, that's a pretty brilliant fable. You know? But, you know, some people would try to argue this is just a bunch of stuff. It didn't really happen. And, you know, I just have to say, I think I disagree with that. I think there's some pretty good evidence that the story of Genesis is reliable history. Now, it is true we don't have any remains of where Abraham lived. Why not? He lived in a tent. I mean, you're not going to have a whole lot. He didn't leave behind him, monuments. Abraham was here, Abraham's city, that kind of stuff. But what we do have is, we know where he lived. He was born in Ur. Now, at the time, let's say of 500 BC or so, when the Old Testament was being put together, Ur was a minor city in the southernmost part of Mesopotamia. But at the time of 2000 BC, it was the greatest city probably in the world. And then according to Genesis, Abraham left Ur and went to Haran. Here are the ruins. Haran was destroyed about 1800 BC. And has never been occupied since that time. There are the ruins of Haran. So if somebody's writing, let's say somebody made up this nice little story so that the children will behave their parents and something like that, writing it, let's say, 500 BC, then Haran had not existed for 1,300 years. Do you think anybody would have known about Haran? Would they have known that it was kind of like a frontier city that you'd go to on the way from Ur to the Promised Land? Did the name Haran even exist as a name that anybody even knew about? No. So I think it's legitimate history. There's some other sort of cool stuff in there. For example, there's the story of Laban. You know the story where Jacob takes off with Rachel and Leah, and Haran chases him down. And he says, "Give me my gods back. How about your camels? And how about your sheep? How about your daughters?" He says, "Give me my gods back." What's up with that? And then they found a legal document in Mesopotamia from around 2000 BC saying, whoever has charge of the household gods inherits all the items of the household. Ah, okay. Was that a tradition that was around, 1,500 years later? I don't think so. All right, so I don't know. I see some actual stuff. And then there's the Ebla tablets. Ebla was a city. It would be in Syria today. Ebla was a powerful city from around 2000 BC to around 2300 BC to around 1800 BC. And on the tablets in Ebla, they found the names Nahor, Serug, Sarai, Abram. These were normal names that normal people had. When? Roughly 2000 BC. Where? In northern Mesopotamia. Now, if somebody's making up a story, probably they wouldn't have had those names. It'd be kind of like, I don't know, let's say you read a letter, and somebody said, this was a letter written, somebody wrote me this letter a couple of days ago, talking about their friend Harold and a Mabel or something like that. You know, that letter was not written a few days ago. That's got to be a few hundred years old. And so the names you find in Genesis are names of people living in Mesopotamia, northern Mesopotamia, roughly 2000 BC. And I assume the names Nahor, Terug, those were not names anybody's using 1,000 years later when this critics say the Old Testament was written. I see some accurate stuff. And then there's Genesis 14:2. You know the story about the battle between Chedorlaomer and the five league city Lot got caught up in that, and then Abram went off and saved. You know that story? And Fern saying, you know that story. And it describes Abraham coming to the crossroads and saying, "Lot, you get the good land, the farming land down there by the Dead Sea. And I'm going to get the marginal land up here in the hills." Now, if you went to Palestine today, it's kind of like not that way, because around the Dead Sea, it's absolute devastation, virtually completely unoccupied. In fact, it's been that way seemingly forever. So what's this Sodom and Gomorrah stuff? Fire and brimstone and judgment, whatever. Well, I don't know. I think it actually happened. In fact, they found, guess how many cities they found when archaeologists finally looked? Five. Now, the air is fairly dry, but they had these rivers that came down. It's kind of like in Chile, western Chile, where it's very dry there, but they have these rivers and they have intense irrigation. And there were five cities. All five cities were destroyed about 2100 BC, all destroyed by fire. I don't know. I'm beginning to think maybe it's real. And then there's the Hittites. By the way, that's actually Sodom. That's the city of Sodom. And they found deposits of sulfur there. That's kind of cool. All right. And then there's the Hittites, where they said, "There's no Hittites." And then they found Hattusha, the capital of the Hittites. And here's the gate to the city of the Hittites. I don't know. I think Old Testament history is probably legit. And then there's Sodom and Gomorrah, the story of judgment. It's not a very happy story. The story of Sodom and Gomorrah is the story of what is going to happen to those who give their life over to sin, which is practically everybody, right? How did God feel about the people living in the city of Sodom and Gomorrah? He loved them. But he couldn't tolerate their sin, so he decided to send down fire and brimstone. But God called Lot out of that city. He calls Lot a righteous man. I wouldn't have called Lot a righteous man personally. I would have said, yeah. He calls Lot a righteous man. All right. I wouldn't have called him a righteous man. I would have said kind of a questionable man. And then Lot's wife turned back, as you know. Don't ever turn back. Don't look back to Sodom. When God calls you out of Sodom, you just get out of Sodom. Okay, we're almost done. I'm almost done. I just give me about 5 more minutes here. All right, and then there's the story of Esau and Jacob. Just like Ishmael and Isaac, God chose Isaac, not Ishmael. And God chose Jacob, not Esau. Now, why did God choose Jacob, not Esau?
Part of the plan.
In Romans chapter 9, he says, Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. Did he hate Esau?
No.
He didn't hate Esau. But he chose Jacob. Did he choose Jacob because he was so amazing?
No.
Why did he choose Jacob? Because of Abraham's
faith.
Because of the faith of Abraham. That's why he chose Jacob. But there's a story here. You see, Esau was the righteous heir. Rightfully, Esau. Esau was the natural heir. As were the Jews. But we are not the natural heir. We shouldn't be prideful about it. Paul talks about that in Romans. He says, don't you Gentiles be prideful about it. But, you know, nevertheless, God chose us because we are the children of promise. The chosen firstborn. God chose, because remember, the firstborn, Esau, should have received the inheritance rightfully. And therefore, the Jews should be sitting pretty right now. But it doesn't work that way. God chose by faith. He chose Jacob. And then Joseph. I'm going to finish out with Joseph and just a few more comments. Again, Abraham, then Isaac, then Jacob. And with Jacob, he's now establishing the nation. Because Jacob marks a transition from the patriarchal period to the period where God has a people. And Jacob took care of that 12 sons. That's awesome. He had 12 sons. So he kind of started a nice little group there. And Jacob had a favorite son. And that favorite son was a prefigure of the Messiah. And the story of Joseph is the story of Jesus. Because Joseph was at the right hand of his father. He was at the right hand of his father. What happened? He became a slave in Egypt. And what did God do? Raised him up to the right hand of the king. So Joseph started at the right hand of a king, became a slave, and then he was raised up to the right hand of a king. That's Jesus, who started at the right hand of the Father, became a slave in Egypt. Where's Egypt? Here it is, folks. You're looking at it, folks. This is Egypt. Because Egypt is always used throughout the Scriptures as a picture, a symbol of those who live in sin. And so, when it says in Hosea 11:1, out of Egypt I called my son, who's that a prophecy of? It's a prophecy of you. It's a prophecy of Joseph. It's a prophecy of Moses. It's a prophecy of Jesus. It's a prophecy of all kinds of stuff. Because God does this. He makes all these pictures, keeps repeating again and again. Why? Because we're slow. So the story of Joseph is the story of Jesus. He was at the right hand with his father. He was the favorite son, and yet he became a slave. And he was a shepherd, as Jesus was a shepherd. Now, he had a dream. Joseph had a dream that he was going to be king of the Jews. Right? And the stars are bowing down and those wheat things are bowing down. And his brothers were so happy and proud for Joseph. Not exactly. So what did he decide to do? They decided to kill him. That's Jesus. Jesus came here as a slave, and his brothers decided to kill him. Why? Because he thought he was going to be a king. But God messed up their plan to kill him, so instead they betrayed him for 20 pieces of silver. I'd like to check out the exchange rate on that one. Jesus was Kate knows this story. Yeah, she's doing foreshadows of what I'm going to say. You're messing me up, Kate. It's all right. But you know, Joseph 30 pieces of silver. Jesus, Joseph 20 pieces of silver. Jesus 30 pieces of silver, a little bit more valuable. And then Joseph ended up enslaved. And he lived amongst the slaves. That's what Jesus did. Jesus came from the right hand of the Father to live as a slave amongst the slaves. Not a very nice compliment about us, but that's the reality. Before we got out of Egypt, we were slaves along with Moses and along with Joseph. But you can't be a prefigure of the Messiah unless you save Israel. Did Joseph save Israel?
Yes.
Yeah, literally. His father's name was Israel, and he saved him. That's pretty good stuff. So I'm going to skip all those cool prophecies in Genesis 49. And I'm just going to say, with Genesis 50, when Jacob dies, the first period of God's working with his people has ended. The patriarchal age has ended. The plan has begun. God is sending his Messiah. So we'll see you next Saturday for Exodus through Deuteronomy. It worked this time. The short lesson got recorded.